From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Georgia is allowing businesses like hair salons and gyms to reopen starting today, even though President Trump has criticized Republican Governor Brian Kemp's decision to do that. In Wisconsin, protesters today are demanding that Democratic Governor Tony Evers quickly end Wisconsin's social distancing restrictions. One Republican Party official told protesters to leave their guns and Confederate flags at home to control the optics of the protest.
Meanwhile, the maker of Lysol is warning people to disregard the president's remarks yesterday, asking scientists to test the use of disinfectant to treat coronavirus.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
Joining us now to talk more about this is ABC News political director Rick Klein. And Rick, let's start with the president's remarks about disinfectant, which are being widely condemned. What's been the reaction to this from other politicians?
The mayor of Atlanta, of course, who's coping with reopening today, is saying it's like the Twilight Zone. Hillary Clinton saying, please don't poison yourself because Donald Trump thinks it could be a good idea. It's beyond condemnation or even beyond mockery. And I think there's a real sense of fear that it could impact people's health and lives. And of course, the White House is saying that the president's comments were misconstrued, but you just heard the soundbite. He is defying his own scientists, people inside his own administration, and defying basic common sense and good healthcare judgment.
Yeah. Let's step back a little bit. We've seen throughout the last few years, the decisions of politicians that they're making really have become fuel for this progressive versus conservative culture war. But are you surprised to see all of this play out during a pandemic?
I think we can't be surprised that politics is going to infuse all of this. But, you know, we saw in our polling today from ABC News and Ipsos that most of the country really thinks that this is a big deal and should not we shouldn't be moving too quickly to open things up. We had 8 in 10 Americans saying even if restrictions were lifted tomorrow, they would still be hesitant to go to a big public place. More than 70% saying that the much more danger in reopening too quickly than in damaging the economy by staying closed too long. So people are taking this seriously, and I think that is that's infecting the political reaction as well. And I think that's why you see the president on both sides of the reopening debate.
Yeah, I mean, yes, he's been on both sides, as you said. I mean, when we're looking at this, we kind of always ask this question. But based on this polling that you see, what do you think this means for the president, that he's kind of on both sides of this issue, trying to get support for himself, really?
Well, I think he's been looking for new enemies, political enemies, and we've seen his approval rating stagnate after a little bit of a bump a few weeks ago. I think his team recognizes that he is going to be judged on his reaction to this pandemic. And based on the early reviews and the public perception so far, that is not a good thing. And I think we've seen his standing erode in battleground states, and I think that's influencing the president's actions as well. And I think his casting about for different bad guys in this, different people and institutions to attack, I think is a symbol of that. And I think also his distance from the governor of Georgia and recognizing that maybe we can't be going as quickly, as aggressively as he may want.
Today, a nearly $500 billion relief bill for businesses and hospitals and increased testing takes effect. Is there an appetite in Congress for more money?
Well, there's a big battle over what's going to be next. Mitch McConnell sounding off about the need to start to think about the debt that we're accumulating as a society, even suggesting that states may have to go bankrupt, which is, you know, not something that actually can happen, we don't believe, under federal law right now. I think there's going to be growing concern about the next tranche of spending. And to be clear, we have already spent ridiculously large numbers of dollars compared to anything that's ever been done before. And that's just to keep the house warm. That's like burning cash just to keep warm. And so there's going to have to be another attempt at spending money. And it's not clear where the political consensus will be.
Before you go, really quickly, polls show this week presumptive Democratic presidential Joe Biden leading in the swing states. But last night, Biden told supporters he thinks Trump will try to delay the election. What are you hearing about where this race stands?
I don't think that there will be a real effort to delay the election. And I think you have seen the vice president's standing go up a bit in the last couple of weeks. But I would posit it's not because of anything he's done. It's about the president. And if this is a referendum on the president and his judgment and leadership so far, then Joe Biden looks pretty good. But he is going to have to be ready for scrutiny and ready for the next 6 months. And he can't be as off of the national radar screen and won't be as off the national radar screen as he has been the last couple of weeks. That will change. It's going to be a close election. And I do think that these choices ahead for the president and to a lesser extent for Biden are going to be determinative. And this is the big issue. Everything else is kind of faded away.
Rick Klein is ABC News political director. Thank you, Rick.
Hey, thank you.
Well, the debate over whether to reopen the economy is strong on social media. Let's get to that with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So let's start with the hashtags that you're seeing in favor of reopening. What are some of the threads you're following?
A lot of hashtags. They all start with reopen America, reopen Georgia, reopen America now. Passionate debating happening. For instance, here's Jean Hill, and she says, I am laid off, I am peed off, and ready to work. And I hereby assume that anyone that says it's too soon to end the forced government shutdown is living off the government and has nothing to lose. A lot of conversation around we need to get back to work.
And what about on the other side, people who are saying it's too early to reopen? Because a lot of the polls are showing that a majority of people want to wait until it truly is safe to reopen.
Absolutely. And a lot of these are coming from Georgians because Georgia is just relaxing the rules about which businesses can be open this weekend. So Korea, the God Hand, that is her Twitter handle, says, just because they're open doesn't mean you have to go. A lot of very rude comments about Georgians and how sensible in their IQ level. I won't share those with you. You can go and look at those memes. And then Albert Ramsey. So bowling alleys are going to jumpstart the Georgia economy? Question mark. A little bit of sarcasm there.
Yeah, I have to say I was a little bit shocked to see that bowling alleys were on the list right at the very start, but we'll watch what happens there. Now, Femi, on Reddit, people who have tested positive for COVID-19 are opening up about their experiences with the virus. What have some of those conversations been like?
These are amazing conversations. The Reddit subreddit is like where all the conversations are happening on one thread. Are COVID-19 positive if you're looking for it? And just in the last couple of hours, I was seeing what people were exchanging in terms of information. Consta8 says day 44, tried to do exercise and suddenly felt badly breathless. Not nice. Also waking up feeling nauseous. Anyone else had this? Instant reply from Minnie Lakes, and she says, still got lung damage, give it more time, sounds like you're gassed, it will get better. So reassurance from other people who are also recovering from COVID-19. Some very scary stories there about how good a shape or poor shape people happen to be in. And then there's another thread, also very useful, where people are saying, I think I have it, and then they're talking about having COVID-19 disease and sharing the information back and forth. So it's a real resource for people who are actually going through COVID-19 disease right now, right out there on Reddit.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear different people's experiences on social media, and a lot of them do line up. We, of course, have heard that one of the symptoms that doctors have talked about now is that people lose their sense of taste and their sense of smell. You're also seeing people share pictures of a possible COVID-19 symptom with the hashtag COVIDToes. What is that all about?
These pictures are not very pretty. They're pictures of toes or feet, and they may well be red or purple, maybe a little bit scabby as well. I hope you're not eating right now, anybody. Dermatologists and doctors are sharing these pictures because they say that they may, and this is just anecdotal evidence at the moment, they may be early symptoms of COVID-19 disease, still doing research. But of course, this COVID-19 disease is only a couple of months old, so they're really looking to see what are the potential range of symptoms. So that's why if you look online, you see hashtag COVID toes, that is why you're seeing those red inflamed toes.
Now, there's got to be a listener out there who just stubbed their toe. Now they think they have COVID-19. But so
I know,
just check
I know.
With your doctor.
Go check. Absolutely. Right. If your toes are red, it may be for some other reason. And this is also just anecdotal evidence, of course.
Okay, one more thing before we let you go, Femi, that is cheering people up online and has gone viral is a video of actor Stanley Tucci making a cocktail. Take a listen.
So, a fair amount of ice in a shaker. Whoops. And use your hands because it's the most hygienic way. getting ice into a shaker.
Okay, so this is following up on our conversation, our important conversation about the barefoot Contessa Ina Garten's huge martini, which, by the way, I made, although not quite as big. But what about the Quarantucci?
Well, Stanley Tucci is on Instagram, on his Instagram. He's beautifully dressed, all in black, looking extremely healthy, very suave. Rachel Conrad found the video on Instagram and she shared it on Twitter. May this video of Stanley Tucci doing a cocktail masterclass be a blessing upon your Twitter feed. Librarian Brie, how's my week been, you ask? I'm still watching the Stanley Tucci cocktail video 3 days later. There were always a pedantic Twitter out there, so some people were picking holes in the way that Tucci is making his cocktail, but for most, it is a thirst trap, and I will leave you to look that up for yourselves.
A new meaning for thirst trap. Okay, Femi, okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And the Centers for Disease Control is now calling for all nursing homes to disclose cases of COVID-19 to residents and the public. Nursing homes and assisted living facilities have particularly been hit hard by this virus. According to state data in Massachusetts, more than 50% of COVID-19 deaths were residents in long-term care facilities. To learn more about what makes these centers so susceptible, we have with us Lona Modi. She's a professor of internal medicine, geriatrics, and epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Lona, we know that the older population is more vulnerable to this virus, but there are particular factors that increase that risk at nursing home facilities. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. There are three major factors: host, the pathogen, and the setting. So the host are nursing home residents or patients. Either they're cognitively impaired or they're physically impaired, and thereby unable to care for themselves either for short-term or long-term. And then there are pathogen or viral-related factors. This particular virus is extremely contagious. It seems to target older adults who have multiple comorbidities. And then we have a setting. People, patients, residents in there share several common areas. And there are short stay and long stay populations that intermingle with each other. This setting is also a bit challenged in terms of resources for infection prevention. They usually have a part-time employee who manages infection control, who also has multiple other responsibilities, including, say, being a unit manager or director of nursing. But furthermore, the staffing is generally suboptimal and they are not paid as well. And thereby, they often go to different nursing homes to make their ends meet.
You know, this brings us really to this inspection data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It revealed that prior to the coronavirus pandemic, nursing homes in at least 35 states had prior infection control deficiencies. Staff at one nursing home in Maryland were reportedly failing to properly store personal urinals in a bathroom used by 8 people. There was another facility in Pennsylvania. Inspectors reportedly failed to make sure caregivers wash their hands. It seems as if the inspections aren't stringent enough. Really, who's being held accountable?
So I think the inspections certainly have done a better job more recently than before. They have now gone in more with a helping attitude than more of a punitive attitude. There is a CMS star rating, which is a quality indicator for nursing homes, and they so far do not have a major infection control or prevention measure as one of their quality indicators, which is where I think we should now move forward of having at least a couple of those indicators to be related to infection prevention. Right now, when the inspections do happen, the nursing homes do get cited, and they have to make rapid changes in their overall infection control operation or any other sort of citation that they receive. But making it a quality indicator, I think, will go a long way in terms of highlighting infection prevention within the overall quality and safety of nursing homes.
That is really interesting and a very important point about infection prevention being one of the major priorities and that focus now being on that. Los Angeles County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer said family members who can should consider pulling loved ones out of nursing homes. Is this something that you'd recommend?
You know, they are in a nursing home for a reason. Our family members, our caregivers, however kind and however well-meaning they may not have adequate training to care for the loved ones at home. So I am looking forward to strategies that nursing homes are coming up with. I mean, one of the important strategies that I've heard about is to do universal testing as soon as possible within the nursing homes and thereby cohort COVID patients from non-COVID patients. That will have tremendous impact on adequate staffing, and safe care of COVID patients as well as non-COVID patients. And open communications from these facilities to their patients, families, and to their local health departments is going to be very important as we help care for this industry.
Yeah, so that's on really the level of the actual nursing homes to take those steps. Do you think, though, we're going to see a change in future policy and oversight of nursing homes following this pandemic?
I'm pretty certain that we are going to see changes in every sector of our lives, including nursing homes. Obviously, it will be best if we get these changes up and running sooner than later, and help them out in coping with a vulnerable population and doing it safely.
That's Lona Modi. She's a professor of internal medicine, geriatrics, and epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Many of these nursing homes and healthcare facilities across the country are now seeking temporary immunity from potential lawsuits. In Tennessee, residents, family members, and former employees of the Gallatin Center for Rehabilitation and Healing are now suing after more than 161 residents caught the virus and 19 people died. One of them was Clara Ruth Summers. Her daughter, Debbie Bolton, is now part of that lawsuit against the facility. She believes the Gallatin Center failed to protect her mother and others. And Debbie, I'm so sorry for your loss. Tell us a little bit more about your mother.
She was in the nursing home because she had the beginning of dementia. She couldn't live by herself. She didn't have any problems except high blood pressure, which was controlled by medication. She was a housewife, raised four children, was born without one hand, but that didn't slow her down at all. She sewed for me, made clothes for me when I was growing up. She, you know, did everything for us. And she liked to read her Bible. She was a very strong Christian. And even since she's passed, I have had people text me or send me a message on Facebook telling me how much of a joy she was to them.
Mm-hmm. She sounds like she was an amazing woman and an amazing mother. We were looking at state data, and it reveals that 161 residents of the nursing home that your mom was staying in tested positive for the virus, and at least 19 have died. Did the nursing home staff inform you at all that your mother was sick, or did they move her to another part of the facility once they realized she was sick?
they called and said she has a severe upper respiratory chest infection. I'm thinking, okay, why don't they test her for COVID-19? Yeah. And they called and said, we've moved her out. She's in another room. Well, within 30 minutes, I called back and said, get an ambulance over there, get my mother to the ER. I want her tested for the coronavirus. She turned 89 on March 25th. And that was the day that I had her removed from the nursing home and sent to the hospital to be tested for COVID-19. We got the test results back on Thursday. And on sometime on Friday night, she was put on the ventilator. But sometime during the night, she had flipped. In Mama's case, she was on a ventilator for less than 48 hours and passed.
Do you think the nursing home could have done more to protect your mom and other residents from this exposure?
I do, because when the health department called and told me, you know, that she was positive, which the hospital had already told me, the report says she started showing symptoms on the Wednesday before I got her out of there the following week. But I literally feel like I lost my mother. And I didn't have to, because my mother, when I tell you she was not in bad health, she wasn't. And toward the end, my mama was my mama, but we had kind of swapped roles. I became the mother and she became the daughter. Yeah. So yeah. I took care of her and I feel like I shortchanged her because I didn't get her out in time.
Oh, Dad.
If I had known COVID-19 was going to come into that nursing home on the 8th when I was over there visiting her, I would have brought her home with me that day. And the thing that hurt so bad when she went to the hospital, I didn't get to tell her bye. I didn't get to go up there and be with her. Unless she died in her sleep, I always thought, I want to be with Mama when she passes, because when I was born, it was me and her. We started this journey together. And when she went, I wanted to be with her when she went. And I didn't get to.
Debbie, I'm so sorry. My sincere condolences.
Thank you. Yeah.
Debbie Bolton is the daughter of Clara Ruth Summers, one of the many nursing home residents to contract the coronavirus. She died just days after her 89th birthday. Thank you so much, Debbie, for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And in a statement to Here and Now, the Gallatin Center says it will continue to partner with local hospitals and the state of Tennessee Department of Health to maintain their focus on the safety of its residents and staff. We're tracking coronavirus developments around the world. Travel restrictions are lifting today in the Czech Republic after health officials found that the number of infections appear to be falling. Residents will be able to gather in groups again and travel internationally.
It is a much different situation in Ecuador. President Trump said today that he'd send the country ventilators and other forms of help after Ecuador's health minister said yesterday that the number of cases is twice as high as previously reported. Ecuador has one of the worst outbreaks in the developing world.
And authorities in Pakistan are trying to limit communal Friday prayers in mosques to slow the disease. That will be more difficult now as the holy Muslim month of Ramadan begins. NPR's Dia Hadid has that story from Islamabad.
On a recent Friday, dozens of worshippers braved the rain and defied the government to gather for communal prayers at the Hanafiya Mosque in the capital. Many of them were elderly, like retiree Awal Khan. He's 72 years old.
It's all in the hands of Allah, and we should take precaution, and we should be afraid of Allah.
Fear God, he says, not the coronavirus. The government's rule to limit Friday congregations to 5 people was only spottily enforced since it was issued in late March. Even when the rules were implemented, worshippers found ways around it. Like at this Islamabad mosque, where worshippers were barred from entering. So after the muazzin called the faithful to prayer, They crammed shoulder to shoulder on the sidewalk outside the mosque and prayed. There have also been reports of violence, like in the port city of Karachi, where worshippers threw rocks at a policewoman and broke her glasses as she tried to block them from entering a mosque. Other clerics openly led crowded congregations, daring the police to stop them. All of this points to a particular issue here in Pakistan. Limiting acts of worship is not easy to do in this deeply religious country. And now, during the holy month of Ramadan, authorities say worshippers can enter the mosques. This is the Prime Minister Imran Khan in a national address. He says, we can't stop worshippers by deploying police and throwing people in jail. And he says there are rules. Worshippers have to stand apart. They have to wear masks and handshakes are banned. But doctors ask, if the government couldn't enforce a limit on congregations, how will it enforce this? Dr. Kaisar Sajjad is the head of the Pakistan Medical Association.
In Pakistan, the law and regulation are not strictly implemented properly.
Sajjad was one of a handful of prominent doctors who wrote a letter published in the local papers on Wednesday, pleading with the government and clerics to keep worshippers home.
It will be a problem if mosques were open for prayers in Ramadan. This will create a lot of problem. The number of cases of coronavirus will increase dramatically, and it will cause a lot of problem for the doctors as well as the paramedics. We have a shortage of ventilators. We have shortage of trained doctors.
He says if Ramadan congregations lead to a rush of new cases, the health sector may be overwhelmed. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
The government has devoted trillions of dollars to fighting the economic devastation of the coronavirus pandemic. Much of that money is being administered by the Federal Reserve. And we want to look now at the Fed's role in the recovery with Mitchell Abulafia. He's a professor of public administration and policy at the State University of New York at Albany. And he's just written a book called Stewards of the Market, How the Federal Reserve Made Sense of the Financial Crisis. Professor, welcome. And during the financial crisis a decade ago, the Fed stepped in, bought a ton of U.S. government bonds. In this crisis, it's going even further than that.
Yes, it's going quite a bit further than that. And probably much to its own surprise, it thought it had really innovated and pushed the boundaries back in 2007 to 2009. But it turns out that those were sort of lessons that they were taking in order to be ready for this much larger disaster.
Well, in a way that our audience can understand, explain what the Fed is doing this time around.
Well, what the Fed is doing basically is providing liquidity. That means money. And it's working like a pump to pump that money into the economy where markets and firms don't have the money they need to do their business. So they are providing the money that banks will loan to firms so that they can remain afloat.
And those firms could be cities, municipalities in this case, with more than a million residents, or counties with more than 2 million residents.
Yes, that is in fact one of the new things that they're doing. In the 2007-2009 period, they were mostly lending into financial markets, which were deeply in trouble, and the markets had frozen up, so they were becoming the buyers. Whereas here, they are lending to corporations and municipalities. There's even a paycheck protection program that they are loaning into.
Do you think that based on what you know about the Fed, especially having looked back into how the Fed handled itself during the financial crisis, that the Federal Reserve is prepared for all this additional responsibility it's taking on now?
That's a very good question. Nobody really knows the answer. It performed surprisingly well in the financial crisis. After a period of not really understanding what was happening, a rather long period, at least until March of 2008, where their theories about what what the market was likely to do were wrong. Basically, they expected it to restore itself. Here, it's not a situation like that. And so it's quite clear what's causing the crisis. They also have the lessons that they learned back in 2007 to 2009 in how to create these facilities that they're creating for various markets, the primary dealer market, the money market, as well as corporations and Main Street and municipalities. Now, that's not to say that there won't be mistakes, but we know that in 2007 to 2009, they ended up actually making money, which they returned to the U.S. Treasury, because there were, of course, interest rates on the loans that they offered, and most people paid back, and they ended up coming out ahead.
You think that'll happen this time?
Hard to say. This is such a different crisis, but the only way to maintain the economy and have a possibility of recovery is to loan openly and aggressively. And so that's what they're doing. This is a lesson they learned in the Great Depression, where the Fed resisted doing that because of mistaken theories. They wanted the banks to pay the cost of having loaned speculators money. And therefore, many banks went bankrupt, and the economy had a lot of trouble recovering.
Is there any limit to how much money the Fed could or should attempt to pump into the economy?
There is theoretically no limit on how much they could pump into the economy. There are many people who believe that potential inflation is a limit. Right now, since inflation is so low, the greater concern is actually deflation, that prices would go down. But this is something that's going to have to be watched. And that's probably the greatest concern at this point.
Mitchell Abulafia, if it weren't for this crisis that we're in right now, we would probably just be talking about your book, which is really about the Fed in the last financial crisis and the extraordinary measures that it took then. So let me just finally ask you, with that crisis all by itself, what did you learn about the Fed in putting this book together? Or what was your biggest surprise as you were putting this book together that you didn't know before?
Basically, I was torn. On the one hand, I felt as though the Fed took a long time to understand what was going on and to interpret it. In the book, I read the verbatim transcripts of their closed-door meetings and see that for a long time they debated, you know, whether to take action, what kind of action was necessary, whether the market would fix it. And I was disappointed to see how long it took. But I was also, on the other hand, surprised at once they began to understand the seriousness of the crisis, I saw that they began to change the narrative to a narrative that recognized this is a systemic crisis and we need to behave differently. They began to create all kinds of new types of loans that actually saved the economy, and not just the national economy, but the world economy. They loaned heavily to foreign central banks and made it possible for basically the world economy to stay afloat.
That is Mitchell Abulafia, whose new book is called Stewards of the Market, How the Federal Reserve Made Sense of the Financial Crisis. Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And let's turn now to Georgia, where businesses like hair salons, tattoo parlors, and bowling alleys will be allowed to reopen today. Georgia is the first state with lockdown orders to ease restrictions. Public health experts say it's too early. Yesterday, even President Trump, who had been calling for states to be liberated from social distancing measures, criticized Governor Brian Kemp's decision.
I didn't like to see spas opening, frankly. I didn't like to see a lot of things happening. And I wasn't happy with it. And I wasn't happy with Brian Kemp.
Let's bring in Emma Hurt, who's a reporter with member station WABE in Atlanta. Emma, Georgia has almost 22,000 cases of COVID-19 and rising. State officials there point to a recent decline in the daily cases. But what are you seeing there today? Are some businesses actually reopening?
Yeah, there are. But there's definitely a split. I mean, there are some salons, for example, that are reopening with masks and sanitation safeguards, social distancing, limited appointments. But then there are a lot of businesses who are definitely not reopening, some who didn't even consider doing so because it doesn't feel safe. I mean, one yoga studio owner told me she was surprised when people asked her if she would even do it because it seemed so out of the realm of what she should be doing right now.
Now, how are people feeling? Because it's not just the business reopening. You'd have to have the customers feeling comfortable enough to go to that business. Are people willing to venture out to, say, a salon right now?
Yeah. I mean, Governor Brian Kemp said it himself that it's up to the private sector right now to convince the public that it's safe for them to come to their businesses. And again, here we're seeing a split. I mean, definitely reports this morning of hair salons booking already through the week, lines outside of barbershops, of people who want their hair cut. But there are also many people who are not feeling okay to do that.
Now, Brian Kemp, the governor, when he did decide to reopen some businesses today, it was almost like he was doing what the president wanted him to do, because the president had been tweeting, liberate this state, liberate that state from the lockdown orders. Now that President Trump says he doesn't agree with what Brian Kemp is doing, what have we heard from the governor?
The governor is sticking with his plan, despite this disapproval from the president. Last night, he released a long list of guidelines for restaurants to use when reopening, because restaurants are up next on Monday, dine-in restaurants. We did learn there was a bit of a change in the president's messaging with Governor Kemp on this. So initially, on Tuesday, the governor spoke with the White House and conversation went well. But by Wednesday, the president's tone had changed after conversations with the nation's top health officials. So Governor Kemp tweeted that he's sticking with his plan, that this is a measured step driven by data and guided by state public health officials, and they're going to continue with the approach.
That is Emma Hurt, a reporter with member station WABE in Atlanta. Emma, thank you.
Thank you.
New research suggests the coronavirus was spreading in the U.S. weeks before public officials previously thought. Modeling from Northeastern University released this week suggests thousands of cases may have spread undetected throughout New York, Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, and Seattle in January and February, long before those cities and others registered an official case count. Alessandro Vespignani is one of the researchers who discovered this. He's the director of the Network Science Institute at Northeastern University and a professor. And Alessandro, your modeling suggests that as of March 1st, when there were only 23 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the five cities you looked at, there may have actually been about 28,000 people infected. So basically, you're saying the outbreak was well underway weeks before we previously thought.
Yeah, our modeling points out to probably a seeding in the United States in those major hotspots in mid-January. So the epidemic had a long time to spread undetected in the population. It's like to have an invisible chain of transmissions and infections going on in the country. And then for a long time, it goes undetected. It's winter. So these are people generally with perhaps mild symptoms, very flu-like. And then at a certain point, you have enough individuals that create a critical mass. And then we start to see the tip of the iceberg. And then you start to have identification of COVID cases.
Mm-hmm. You know, we know that hospitals in those cities that you studied were not overwhelmed with patients in January and February. You mentioned that folks could have had flu-like symptoms, but then were there also those who were asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic spreaders back then?
Obviously, a large number of infections are asymptomatic, and a large number of infections are what we call subclinical, so they don't have severe or symptoms. They have just mild symptoms. It's people that doesn't get to any hospital or emergency room. And so unless you have a large number of cases, truly large, you don't see people going to the hospital, and you don't see the number of deaths that we are unfortunately witnessing now, because we have really hundreds of thousands and millions of infections.
Another question I have for you in this is that could there have been more people who died who just were not diagnosed during that time?
You know, what happened is, and that's not just in the United States, but all over the world, just think about Europe as well. January, February, no country in the world had the capacity to do mass testing for cases. And so the policy generally adopted was to test people with travel history, so that having symptoms like COVID, but that had a link of travel to China. But that was not the case. When you start to have those invisible chain of transmission of the disease, the link with China is lost. And then you have people perhaps traveling from UK. What happens is that you do not start confirming cases and deaths because actually you are not testing. Now I think is a news of a couple of days ago that some deaths in mid-February in California has been linked to COVID. And so that actually reinforced the finding of our modeling.
What did you do to get the word out about this undetected spread of the virus when you discovered it? And what response did you get from authorities who could have possibly done something with this information?
You know, the modeling community was aware of those results, and actually there were other modeling teams are pointing out to similar, undetected spread. We presented to agencies, and you know, it has always been considered seriously the work, and we have also it has also prompted to some reaction with policymakers, even locally. You know, many people tell me, "Oh, you were crying the wolf, and nobody was listening." No, it's not that the case. But in our case, you have just numbers. Models telling you, look, you have many cases in the country, but then you don't see them yet in hospitals, as you were saying. You don't see the deaths. You can understand how much it's difficult to take decision in such a context and say, well, I will shut down a country because of a model. I think the information was out there, was circulated, and was considered.
Alessandro, I want to ask you about something else. So one scientist, Dr. Donald Burke, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh, a graduate school of public health, told the New York Times he thought your estimates were on the high side. How big of a margin of error are your estimates?
Well, you have always confidence interval, but I think what the data are clearly telling that if we don't really test and trace contacts in a very aggressive way, this disease might spread unnoticed in an invisible way, and we don't want that to happen again.
That's Alessandro Vespignani, director of the Network Science Institute at Northeastern University. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.